next case for argument this morning is United States against Burke.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Susan Pablo, and I represent Edward Burke, the appellant in this matter, and we raise three issues for your consideration. The first deals with the admission of evidence that Mr. Burke's criminal background was very violent and extensive. As Your Honors are aware, he was tried on a charge of being a felon in possession. Prior to trial, there was a stipulation to the fact that he did have a felony conviction. Earlier in the testimony of Officer Gillerlane, there was also a testimony indicating that he was a convicted felon. At that time, however, the court gave the jury a limiting instruction indicating what they could consider the evidence for. Despite all that, later in the direct examination of Officer Gillerlane, it was elicited from him that Mr. Burke's background was very violent and extensive. There was no objection by Mr. Burke's trial counsel, and we submit that the fact that there was no objection.
What do you think the lawyer should have done? Ask the judge to tell the jury, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please do not think about the fact that the defendant's background is very violent and extensive. That's like saying, for the next 30 seconds, do not sound in your head the word rhinoceros. Right? It just gets them to think more about the fact that his background is violent and extensive.
Respect.
And the alternative was to ask for a mistrial. Would it have been sensible to ask for a mistrial here?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree. I think a curative instruction, as given earlier to the jury, would have been the appropriate response at that point, so that the jury, who are presumed to follow the instructions, would be allowed.
That's an awful lot to put on jurors' heads. A lawyer might think that this would just go by unnoticed. Once you ask the judge to intervene, the judge is now telling the jury, yes, indeed, his background is very violent and extensive, but please don't consider that.
Your Honor, also, once the evidence is out there, however, the jury feels they're free to consider it, as opposed to getting that limiting instruction.
You can ask the mistrial question, but you don't seem to think that a mistrial would have been the right step.
Judge, I believe that the trial counsel could have asked for a mistrial, certainly failure to do so.
You think a request for a mistrial was counsel's absolute duty? And of course, whether you want a mistrial depends on whether you think the trial is otherwise going reasonably well for your client.
Your Honor, I don't know that it would be his absolute duty, but I will say in this particular case where he is charged with being a felon in possession, the very nature of what came out about his background would require his trial counsel to ask for a mistrial in that circumstance.
Would require a request for a mistrial? So even if you thought that the government's witnesses had really been pretty lame and the evidence was as weak as it was able to be in a case of this sort, the lawyer must ask for a mistrial, give the government a chance to repair its case the second time around. So the reason I'm asking these kinds of questions is you're making an ineffective assistance argument. I don't see how one could adjudicate an ineffective assistance argument on direct appeal without asking the lawyer why he didn't object. Did he think it was going to create the elephant in the room problem for the jury? Did he think about the mistrial possibility? Why did he choose to go forward rather than ask for a mistrial? Well, we don't know the answers to those questions. Those are the kinds of questions that one would explore on a collateral attack if it was interesting. So I wonder whether you want to pursue an ineffective assistance claim, because the one thing that we can be sure to tell you is that if you pursue it now and do reject it because you don't have the answers to those questions, you can't renew it later under 2255. You can't renew it or any other kind of ineffective assistance claim under 2255. But is it really something you want to present?
Your Honor, at the time that I submitted the brief, I will tell the court, as Your Honor argues, as the government argued in their brief, that it was a matter of strategy. It appeared to me that based on the type of case this is, and based on the type of evidence that was elicited, no reasonable strategy could be gained from simply ignoring it.
Well, I've already given you a reason. At the lawyer might have thought the only effective result, the only effective thing to do is to end this trial and have another one. And counsel may or may not have thought that that was the best thing to do. We don't know. We have no clue what counsel was thinking because no one has asked her. It's not in the record. Well, I ask again, is this an argument you want to pursue now at a time when the record is silent?
Your Honor, without the benefit of continued conference with my client, I've already submitted the brief.
But you could still argue that there was a due process violation. Not being a bind on the ineffective assistance argument, but you can fair trial based on this record, period.
I do believe that that is the case, Your Honor. I think, and again, I hate to keep repeating myself, but he's charged with being a felon in possession.
What was his defense?
Oh, we'll give you a week to tell us whether you really want to maintain this ineffective assistance claim, with the understanding that if you want to pursue it now, no ineffective assistance claim can be made later in 2255, not on this theory and not on any other theory, because you only get to make an ineffective assistance claim once.
Respectfully, I'll take advantage of Your Honor's offer.
And tell me that we'll do it withdrawn. Or you'll tell
us in a
week.
I can let you know in a week, Your Honor, whether or not I want to continue my argument as
to the tell us in a week.
What was his defense?
It appeared that at trial, counsel argued the sufficiency of the informant. Mr. Burke was taken to the informant's home. The informant picks him up, takes him to the house. He tried to set up a controlled buy with surveillance the day before. At that time, when officers were watching, he was wired up. He was nowhere to be found. So the next day, the informant picks him up, takes him there, call the officer, say, he's at my house, and then the officer says, send him out with the gun. It appeared that trial counsel was arguing the credibility of what went on in the house.
The issue is whether it wasn't a felon. Yes, he was. And did he possess the gun? So where is the defense that he didn't?
Your Honor, it appeared that the knowing possession element came from the argument that...
He didn't testify, did he?
He did not.
Oh. So how do you read this case?
Your Honor,
I was objecting to, and even getting objections sustained to this criminal history or violent history, whatever the exact phraseology was of the officer who answered that question. How does that help you?
I think at trial, Mr. Burke tried to defend on the idea that he was brought to the informant's house. The officer said, send him out with the gun. He's got a blanket wrapped around the gun. The officer testified, I believe, that he saw the end of it protruding. He was taking it to the informant's van. There was no further intent to sell it or do anything else
with it. You have to convince the jury that there was a reasonable doubt that he didn't have the gun with the towel wrapped around it. Otherwise, you're going to lose this case.
Your Honor, I don't know what the jury would do without considering his violent or extensive background if they believe that that's what the informant set up.
It's hard for me to see that little statement would be prejudicial error here, requiring a whole new trial. Even if there had been an objection by counsel and had been overruled or whatever.
Again, Your Honor, I think that absent that evidence regarding Mr. Burke's background, I think the jury would have been free to consider, look, when they tried to set up a control buy, he's nowhere to be found. The next day, the informant picks him up, takes him to his house, gets the cops sitting outside, and the cops says, send him out with the gun, so they say, here, walk outside. That's not necessarily... I understand your Honor.
I didn't hear an entrapment defense or a necessity defense or something. So,
They were.
You have to show if this is going to be retried, you have to show prejudicial error. Where is it?
Those defenses were not put forth at trial. And I would submit that, based on the facts that are left, that a jury could possibly infer that Mr. Burke did not have knowing possession of the gun. Your Honors, I also, in addition, submit an my time is up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Beach.
May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Beach. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney, and I represent the United States in this matter. Just for a point of clarification, Your Honor, since the ineffective assistance of counsel claim has been withdrawn, I believe that I don't need to respond to it during this proceeding. Is that correct?
This is your only chance to get an oral argument, and you don't know yet whether it will be withdrawn, so...
Thank you, Your Honor.
You won't be asked to come back later.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Burke has not shown that the omission of Officer Gilliland's testimony that Mr. Burke's criminal history was very violent and extensive, either affected his substantial rights or was a miscarriage of justice. Given the limited strength of the government's evidence that Mr. Burke knowingly possessed this firearm,
the prosecutor asked that that be struck.
I'm sorry?
And the prosecutor asked that that be struck. There's this agreement between the prosecutor and defense counsel. You have a witness who blurts out something that's in violation of the agreement. It doesn't be the prosecutor's interest as much as the defense counsel's to have the judge do something.
Your Honor, I believe it's reasonably inferred from the record that trial counsel may have been caught off guard by the officer's response.
Well, that's just the definition of what happens when a witness blurts out a non-responsive answer. But still, you need to do something.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe the record shows that the trial counsel then attempted to steer the witness back onto track to highlight the fact that the officer knew at that time that the defendant was a convicted felon, not the comment that the officer had made. Your Honor, the government's overwhelming evidence at trial included the testimony of two police officers who saw the defendant standing outside the informant's apartment holding a firearm, the barrel of which protruded approximately 1 foot outside of a blanket. It also included the testimony of those two officers who then chased the defendant into the informant's apartment and saw the defendant throw the gun to the ground and then later watched the gun being picked up by the other police officers. The government's evidence also included the two confessions of the defendant. Initially, the defendant confessed to Sergeant Loughran after he'd been Mirandized that he...
After what?
I'm sorry, after the defendant had been advised of his Miranda rights, Your Honor.
Mirandized sounds somewhat like after he'd been galvanized, he'd been dipped in a tank full of zinc and an electric current applied. He'd probably do torture.
Yes, Your Honor. After he was advised of his rights pursuant to Miranda, that he was at the informant's residence to sell the shotgun to an acquaintance's brother for $250. Later on, under questioning by an ATF special agent, the defendant further admitted that he was holding a rifle or shotgun at the time he was arrested, that he was at the informant's residence to sell the gun to the informant's cousin, that he was going to receive $75 for selling the gun, and that he was carrying the gun to the informant's van at the time he was stopped by the police officers. And finally, the government's evidence also included tape recordings and transcripts of telephone calls between the defendant and the informant's girlfriend, in which the defendant explicitly asked if somebody's going to buy the shotgun, and then the defendant and the informant's girlfriend then engage in a dialogue about a previous shotgun that had been sold and then the obtaining of two other handguns that the defendant was going to obtain after robbing a gun store. The government's evidence trial also proved that the defendant's voice was that of the male caller on the telephone calls with the informant's girlfriend. Both the special agent Ladno, who got the second confession from the defendant, as well as Sergeant Loughran, who received the first confession from the defendant, both Agent Ladno and Officer Gilliland, who were both present for the defendant's 30 or 45 minute interview, listened to the tape of the January 7th calls and recognized the voice of the defendant from their interview of the defendant. Also, the informant's girlfriend, who engaged in the two telephone calls with the defendant, identified the defendant's voice as being the voice that was in her apartment on the day Mr. Burke was arrested there. As such, based on the overwhelming strength of the government's evidence, Mr. Burke cannot satisfy the plain error standard of review. Specifically, he cannot show that his substantial rights were affected or that the admission of Officer Gilliland's comment affected the integrity of the proceedings. Before I lose this issue, however, I'd like to impress upon the court that it is reasonably clear from the record that the government's trial attorney did not intend to solicit from Officer Gilliland that the defendant's criminal history is very violent and extensive. Specifically, prior to asking Officer Gilliland initially about the defendant's criminal history, the government requested a limiting instruction from the court, and the court gave the instruction and explained that the information was coming in just to explain why certain investigative steps were taken.
Well, the answer was not responsive to the question.
The second time around, yes, Your Honor, I would agree.
And it wasn't a repeat during closing argument or anything like that. It wasn't harped on. It was just one isolated incident, and the question was, were you aware of his criminal record or something, or his record? And the answer probably should have been yes, and it hadn't gone on to anything else.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The first time it came out, the officer testified that he knew the defendant was a convicted felon. The second time, in an effort to apparently reorient the jury as to the fact that the defendant's possession was illegal because the defendant was a convicted felon, the trial AUSA asked the officer, and so what did you know about his criminal history? And as opposed to responding with, he was a convicted felon, the officer then said that it was very violent and extensive. The trial AUSA then immediately followed up with leading questions to say, and you had knowledge that he was a convicted felon at the time. The officer then agreed. The AUSA then asked, and you knew that was a crime, right, to get the officer back on track. Accordingly, it is reasonably inferred that the government's trial counsel did not intentionally elicit this statement from Officer Gilliland. As to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the defendant cannot meet either prong of the Strickland test, starting with the defendant cannot prove that he was prejudiced by his trial counsel's performance. As I've discussed, the government's evidence was overwhelming in this case. He cannot show that but for the admission of Officer Gilliland's testimony, the outcome would have been different. As to the reasonableness of his trial counsel's performance, it is not unreasonable for a trial counsel to not object to otherwise prejudicial information out of the concern of highlighting or emphasizing that information, especially in a situation like this where it was a single fleeting reference that was never addressed again by the government, which the government immediately steered the witness away from. To object would have, could have served to just emphasize this comment in the mind of the jury. Since the record is unsupplemented, the court, based on the highly deferential standard given to the performance of trial counsel, we believe that the record shows that the counsel's performance was reasonable. As to the defendant's third point, that the court erroneously increased his base level offense based on its finding that his offense involved four firearms. Specifically, Note 6 of the Sentencing Guidelines, Section 2K2.1B1A, sets forth that those firearms that were unlawfully sought to be obtained, unlawfully possessed, or unlawfully distributed are included in the determining the number of firearms in an offense. Mr. Burke's offense and relevant conduct involved four firearms, specifically the shotgun he was convicted of possessing, the two pistols that he was discussing with the informant's girlfriend on the January 7th phone calls obtaining for the informant after he robbed a gun store. The discussion of the two pistols occurred during his trying to get the informant, or trying to find out if the informant would sell the shotgun for the defendant. And finally, as to the 410 shotgun that was mentioned during the telephone calls, first of all, the informant's girlfriend asked Mr. Burke during that call, or mentioned to the defendant during the call, that the buyer of the shotgun Mr. Burke was trying to sell didn't want any, and the next one because you already got was 600 on the 410. 410 was the gauge of the shotgun Mr. Burke was found to have been involved in his offense. In response to the informant's girlfriend's statement, Mr. Burke responded, "Okay, I gotcha. And although the district court did not explicitly consider this during its determination of the number of firearms involved, The government also submitted with the sentencing memorandum a transcript of a telephone call from January 2nd, 2004 between the informant and one of Mr. Burke's co-defendants. And during that conversation, the co-defendant and the informant explicitly discussed the selling of this 410 shotgun, which Mr. Burke was originally charged with in the superseding indictment. Mr. Burke claims that the content of his conversations with the informant's girlfriends were either innocuous or made by a dojo, or they're lied by the content of the conversations themselves. Specifically, Mr. Burke almost immediately starts off his conversation with the informant's girlfriend by saying, "Oh, I'm calling to see if somebody, gonna buy the shotgun." From that point on, they go on to discuss the two pistols and the 410 shotgun. And whether it was made by a dojo, in this situation, Mr. Burke was explicitly describing where he was going to get the pistols to, the amount of them. I see that my time is up, Your Honor. Unless you have any further questions, the government would ask that this court affirm Mr. Burke's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Leach. Anything further, counsel?
I would briefly respond to the sentencing argument that Mr. Veach put forth. The judge entered a two-point enhancement on the base offense level based on a finding of three firearms or more. The transcripts that were submitted as part of the sentencing memorandum and that were played at trial, as I indicated in my brief, the two pistols are really what put him over the edge in the finding of three firearms or more, and he's talking about the possibility of it. There's really nothing in that transcript that can be deemed that he intends to do it, that he can do it, that can in any way distinguish it from mere talk. For that, I submit that the two-point enhancement was inappropriate. I'd ask that Your Honors consider all the arguments put forth on behalf of Mr. Burke. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Powell, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case, the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case this morning is Lisa.